So last week we looked at lesson 1, unit 7, and we were looking at canto, the second canto, chapter 8 of the Now in this, the 8th chapter, King Parikit inquired from Sukadeva Goswami, how did Narada Muni explain the transcendental qualities of the Lord, who is without material qualities, and before whom did he speak? That was text number one. And so the Lord there is described as being without material qualities. What was the Sanskrit word they used to describe the Lord as having no material qualities? Aguna, yes, aguna. Or we can sometimes say nirguna or aguna has the same meaning. It means without quality. So why would we describe the Lord as being aguna if that means without quality? Without material quality. Yeah. What's that? So you see in the homework question, that's question one actually. And it's actually mentioned in the purport there. It does not mean he has no quality, but he has no material quality. He is transcendental to all material conceptions, and thus he is described as aguna. So, now, Parikit Maharaj glorified the hearing of the Srimad Bhagavatam and before he went on to ask his other questions. We understand that Lord Brahma asked Narada Muni to explain the transcendental qualities of the Lord, the teachings about the transcendental qualities of the Lord. And Parikit Maharaj is asking Sukadeva Goswami exactly how did he do that and who did he do that with, for. So Parikit Maharaj then went on to say that please continue narrating the Srimad Bhagavatam so that I can place my mind upon that Supreme Soul, Lord Krishna, being completely freed from material qualities, thus relinquish this body. So, you know, in other words, he wants him to continue his hearing right to the very end of his life, because he understands, he's saying there that by hearing, Parikit Maharaj will also become completely freed from material qualities, because his mind will be absorbed in Lord Sri Krishna, who is completely transcendental. So his mind won't be absorbed in anything material. It will be absorbed, so he will be liberated. Now, in the purport, Prabhupada made the statement that, you know, he'd already given up his connections with his kingdom, his family, the most attractive features of materialism, but still he was conscious of his material body. And he wanted to be free from such bondage also by constant association with the Lord. So, now, the Acharyas described that particular verse, text number 3, as being quite significant in that, as described in the Bhakti Sandarbha by Jiva Goswami, that the word Hari in that verse refers to the various incarnations of the Lord, and the phrase Akalatmani Krishna refers to Lord Krishna, in whom all incarnations are present, the friend of Arjuna. So, in essence, the verse is saying that the understanding is that if one continues to hear about the various incarnations of the Lord, one's mind gradually becomes purified of all material contaminations and conditioning, and that qualifies one to actually become fixed in hearing about Krishna. Are you reading the synonyms, are you? You're reading from the synonyms?
No, you just mentioned from and also before that, Hari.
Okay. See, in Śrīla Prabhupāda's Śrīmad Bhāgavatam, we can look at the word. Akila Atmani, unto the Supreme Soul, Krishna, unto Lord Krishna. So, Akila Atmani, with further analysis of the word in the Bhakti Sandarbha, means to Lord Krishna, the original Supreme Personality of Godhead, in whom all incarnations are present. That's the complete understanding of that term. Previously, Hare is mentioned in the previous verse, verse 2. So there where Parikit is saying, please, he wants to continue the narrations concerning the Lord, it is referring to his various incarnations. And by Lord Brahma has given just a brief introduction to the various incarnations and discussions about he wants Narada Muni to expand those discussions about the incarnations of the Lord. Hearing about that qualifies one to eventually hear about Krishna and to fix one's mind in Krishna. It purifies one of the material contamination. So therefore, where Srila Prabhupada is saying in the purport that he was still conscious of his material body. So, Parikit Maharaj wants to come to the level of hearing about Krishna where he's not even conscious of his material body. He's already given up everything else. There's some consciousness, there. And he wants to be free from all that. He understands that by hearing about the various incarnations of the Lord, it will bring him to that point of purification. And that level of purification is the proper level to hear about Krishna's pastimes in, fixed meditation. One has to be a little careful about hearing the pastimes of Krishna when one is materially absorbed. It's better to be somewhat purified. one is more likely to create some blunder on the path of, you know, by seeing Krishna as an ordinary human being, if one is still in the bodily concept of life. You know, when we hear about the various incarnations of the Lord, such as, you know, Lord Brahma, you know, he took three steps, covered the entire universe. So it's really easy, you know, to accept, oh, here is the Supreme Lord doing something quite transcendental. When we hear of you know, Krishna performing some of these activities which are very human-like, it's extremely easy to make the mistake that, oh, you know, he can't be God, because it is. But if one is on the transcendental platform, you know, not seeing things in a material way, then when one hears about Krishna, it's less likely that one will make that mistake, you know, when hearing about Krishna. So that's sort of the intention of, you know, Purikit Maharaj's questioning at the very beginning of this chapter 8. the nice analogy there in that purport of text 3, that Lord Krishna is like the sun, material contamination is like the darkness. As the presence of the sun dissipates darkness, constant engagement and association of Lord Sri Krishna frees one from the contamination of material qualities. Text number 4, of course, continues. The persons who hear Srimad Bhagavatam regularly and are always taking the matter very seriously will have the personality of Godhead Sri Krishna manifested in their hearts within a short time. So it's leading up to that level by constantly hearing the Srimad Bhagavatam from the beginning, the various incarnations or what have you. It leads to the point where one can situate Krishna within the heart. That hearing and chanting itself allows one to come to the qualification where one can remember Krishna, you know, very effortlessly, because Krishna will actually help sitting within the heart. We see in verse number 5 there's a nice analogy again. The sound incarnation of Lord Krishna, that is the Srimad Bhagavatam, enters into the heart of a self-realized devotee, sits on the lotus flower of his loving relationship, and thus cleanses the dust of material associations such as lust, anger and hankering. Thus it acts like the autumnal rains upon pools of muddy water. So the autumnal rains, sometimes pools of water become somewhat muddy, but if they're, you know, literally flushed out by, you know, strong currents, constant pure water, gradually what's left is just, you know, pure water within those reservoirs of water. So, yes.
In other places, you know, this association, such as, you know, lust, anger and greed, I've heard, you know, this anchoring is coming. So I've heard of lust, anger and greed.
Yes.
So here anchoring, is it similar to greed? What's the concept of anchoring? Isn't double beneficial by lust, anger and greed?
Yes.
Those are ghosts of hellish planet, you know. Lust, anger and greed are the ghosts of the hellish planet.
Yeah, it's hankering means we're wanting something we don't have. We're hankering for something. Means that.
What is that we want more and more?
Well, it includes lust and greed in the sense. It depends how strong our hankering is. You know, greed is like an extension of lust. It's like a higher degree. You know, one may lust we can consider to be like a desire for something, and greed is when that desire is just you know, too high. Yeah. So it's an extension. It's a lamentation generally is you know, we hanker for something that we, you know, haven't got, and when we get it, we lament that we've got it. Or if we lose it, we lament that we've lost it. When we get it, we lament that it wasn't quite what we it didn't bring the happiness we thought it would. Or if it goes, then we lament. I think Prabhupada gives the example that there's a particular type of laddu. Have you heard this? Very, very, very famous. Very famous. Yeah. It causes everyone to lament. Yeah, because if someone hasn't tasted it, they lament. Oh, I haven't tasted this, you know, this is wonderful. And if someone does get to taste it, then they lament that, oh, you know, it's so nice, and you know, now I don't have that, you know. So it's lamenting. So hankering and lamenting. Yeah. Very interesting here that Parikit Maharaj is describing this constant hearing about Srimad Bhagavatam to cleanse the polluted heart. In the purport, Prabhupada expands upon this idea and the analogy given here. So the analogy is actually, from the translation, it acts like autumnal rains of muddy water. So, autumnal rains, it indicates that something is happening on quite a large scale. The cleansing is happening on a large scale. In other words, by the hearing, by Krishna Kirtan, Krishna Katha, it can cleanse the hearts of everybody, many, many persons. Whereas other processes, a person can only purify their own heart. So when a devotee follows his process of purification, he purifies everyone around him. But when a yogi or a jnani or a kami follows their process of purification, they only purify themselves. That's the significance there of this, you know. Therefore, as Prabhupada mentions in the purport, that a single pure devotee can deliver all the fallen souls of the world. Just one single pure devotee who takes up that process of hearing and chanting about the Lord. It can purify everyone who comes into contact with that. So these are just some preliminary verses that Maharaj Parikit spoke before he asked many, many other questions. there's another very nice analogy there, that a pure devotee of the Lord, whose heart has once been cleansed by the process of devotional service, never relinquishes the lotus feet of Lord Krishna. For they fully satisfy him as a traveller is satisfied at home after a troubled journey. So sometimes a traveller may go out and earn great wealth, and of course when they return home, there's no need for them to go out anymore because they have achieved what they wanted, that great wealth. So a traveller is satisfied home after a troubled journey. And you know, in other lectures I've seen where Srila Prabhupada mentioned that even returning home is enough to give some satisfaction of the heart. That, you know, a traveller undergoes a lot of difficulties travelling to achieve his goals, and then having achieved that, and then even on the process, oh, now I'm returning home, and then his thoughts return to, you know, those you know, persons of affection waiting at home, and even the difficulties of travelling home are not so intense, because his mind is, you know, once again satisfied, oh yes, I'm going home, and his thoughts are with those. So what to speak of when he actually arrives home. So just a little bit of preliminary information just to inspire us to go on hearing about the Srimad Bhagavatam. There is you know, also just some of the understanding of the Srimad Bhagavatam. We see that later on in verse number 25, where Narada Muni says, Prikit, I think he's speaking to Sukadeva Goswami, that you are as good as Brahma. Others follow custom only, as followed by the previous philosophical speculators. Now, in essence, and we see in Prabhupada's purport that he describes the various other six, you know, specifically six great rishis. There is Gautama, Kanada, Jaimini, Kapila, Astavakra, Patanjali. various personalities who presented philosophical paths by themselves. As Prabhupada says, you know, in their own way of thinking, exactly like modern philosophers and mental speculators. The difference between the six philosophical paths put forward by the renowned sages and that of Sukadeva Goswami is that all those sages speak the facts according to their own thinking, but Sukadeva Goswami presents the knowledge which comes down directly from Brahma, who is educated by the Supreme Lord. So if I were to ask you, why can the knowledge of the philosophical speculators never be perfect, as mentioned in verses 25 and 26, which is one of the homework questions, you might reply something like, such knowledge is never perfect because it is a product, it is produced by an imperfect mind. They're speaking facts according to their own thinking. And then looking at verse number 26, Verse 26 describes that I learn of Brahma because of my drinking the nectar of the message of the infallible personality of Godhead. I do not feel any sort of exhaustion. So here is described that this achyutigata is different from that which is produced by the imperfect mind. Achyutigata means it comes from the discussion coming from the infallible Lord himself. The message is infallible, achyuta, infallible. Achyutigata, a message is infallible because it's come from the infallible Lord. So in those verses it describes two. One, that others follow custom only, as followed by the previous philosophical speculators, whereas Pariksit Maharaj is actually satisfied by that which is coming from the infallible Lord. So of course, last week we began in chapter 9 describing in verse 54 of chapter 7 Lord Brahma asked Narada Muni, you describe that same science that come down from the Lord to Brahma like that, you expand that. So Sukadeva Goswami in chapter 9, he then commenced to give the answers by reciting the Srimad Bhagavatam. And of course, he was reciting the Bhagavatam, which was actually heard by Lord Brahma in Lord Brahma's first day, Brahma Kalpi. The first day of Brahma. That's when Lord Brahma received this knowledge. You see that in verse 28. Brahma Kalpi, the millennium in which Brahma was first generated. So this is basically Lord Brahma. So I think, Chris, you asked me about, gradually to go into more detail about the message. So just as we go through this, you'll pick up, little bits and pieces of information here. You've got to hang on to them little gems because they're sort of spread here and there. To form a whole picture, but
verse 6, 2.8.6, right? It says the pure devotee of the Lord, whose heart has been cleansed by the process of devotion service, etc., goes on. So here it says the heart has been cleansed.
Yes.
Many times we see in Bhagavad Gita when Krishna says clean. Mind,
yes.
So somewhere there is some point they say mind, some point they say heart. So what's the relationship between the mind and the heart?
Yes, it's in essence it's the same thing. Well, because we tend, we tend to sort of think of the mind in terms of being in the brain, but the soul is situated in the heart. So, the actual consciousness is situated in the heart. So, So our conscious mind is situated in the heart. That's where the soul is. But we tend to think in terms of the brain, that the mind is in the brain. So, you know, by speaking in terms of the heart, gradually the Vedas are getting us used to the fact that where the soul is situated as the source of the real conscious living entity. But sometimes, because that's very difficult for people to understand, therefore it may be referred to the mind, just the mind. That's what people usually, if you say the mind, people can very readily refer to the mind, but they refer to it as within the brain. The brain is something like a machine that can be utilized by the conscious living entity. It's something like a type, you know, for instance, if you have a typewriter that if you get someone who's a brilliant scholar at writing, you can give them an ordinary typewriter and they'll still turn out some beautiful literature. So Srila Prabhupada, in his early days, you know, a lot of this typing was done on a little typewriter, no fancy computer and what have you. So because the conscious being using the machine, it didn't matter whether he had you know, sophisticated machinery or very simple machinery, the conscious person was transcendental to the machinery. So similarly, a devotee who's actually transcendental, you know, they're not dependent upon the machinery of the brain, its limitations or capabilities as to what they can do with their consciousness. But a conditioned soul is somewhat limited to, you know, the capacities of the actual machinery of the brain. Yeah.
The mind is
seated, yeah. The machinery is there, but the consciousness is somewhere else. The conscious being is actually utilizing the machinery, but still a devotee who is transcendental is not limited by the machinery that they may be given. They can transcend that. So similarly, you know, Gaur Kishore Das Babaji was blind, but you couldn't hide anything from him. You know, they're not dependent upon the machinery of the body. Yes, so that was a very nice quote, Chris. It was good. That's what we need to be able to do, is to, you know, immediately refer to Shastra. And if we can actually quote an actual location, that's very good. So what we're going to go back to now is the answers that Sukadeva Goswami is giving to Maharaj Parikit's question. Sorry. would anyone like to summarize? Oh, excuse me. Haribol? Yes, I'm giving class. Can I see you after? 5 o'clock. Probably more like 6. Yeah, Hare Krishna. Right. Who would like to summarize who would like to say what the first question was? What was the first question? Which was given in verse 7. Who can remember? Verse 7 of the 8th chapter. What's the essence of that question? Does the living entity acquire the body accidentally, or is there some, cause? We discussed that the answer was given in the first 3 verses. It was quite a... it's important that we had to see Bhakti Sara, make sure that last week's class does go up. Evidently it hasn't gone up, because there was a very... We devoted a lot of the class to answering this question, which is quite important. We don't have time to go over it again, so it would be a shame to lose that. But if anyone wants the answer to that first question, it's there in last week's lesson, which was recorded, but doesn't seem to have gone up. But anyway, in summary... The cause? What was the cause? What did we ascertain to be the cause? So, influenced by the energy of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. That is the cause. And as you say, there are other things involved. We would ask, well, why would the Lord, do such a thing? And that is because the living entity desired it. But of course, the living entity may desire something, but if the Lord doesn't become the cause for that manifesting, the living entity can't... his cause, his desire is not sufficient to actually manifest the material world and all the material bodies. So really, that's also described in... So in one sense, as you were describing, the living entity is a primary cause, can be considered in one way, because the Lord wouldn't have done it without his cause. But in another sense, the actual cause then becomes the Lord, because that's the only way that the material bodies, the material world, can actually be manifested by his energy.
Another way of looking at it, the Lord is independent, so even if his desire is from the living entity side, so since he's independent, he can act independently, so he becomes the...
Yes, that's right, yeah. The result, of course, is that the living entity appears in so many forms offered by the external energy.
The Lord being independent, he is not dependent on actually the desire of the living entity.
Yeah.
So he can act independently. He is independent. So ultimately, he is the reason.
What he's saying is that because... That desire can't force the Lord or cause the Lord to do anything, because the Lord's independent from the living entity's desire. So that's right. I can vouch for that. All right. What is the solution? Given in verse 3. giving up the misconceptions of I and mine. Right? So that answered that question. Does he acquire a body accidentally or by some cause? Yes, there is a cause. He is influenced by the energy of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and therefore he acquires so many bodies. The solution is to give up the conception of I and mine, because, as we described, it is the example was given just like a the relationship is just like a dreamer seeing his own body working. Prabhupada gives in the purport and in the many lectures that Prabhupada gives, he describes it actually the soul does not actually fall. You know, the living entity does not ever become a material being. The living entity never loses his spiritual qualities. The living entity never loses his eternal relationship with Krishna. But his identifying with the material world, that actually has happened. He's thinking that that has happened, but it hasn't. And we were discussing after class, Gopa Brindesh and myself, that does the living entity suffer in the material world? Yes, it must be the living entity, and the material body can't suffer because it's not a conscious living being. So it must be the living entity who is suffering. So here's the cause of his sufferings in one sense. But in another sense, his suffering is apparent because the spirit soul doesn't really suffer. It's because he's associating himself with the material body he suffers, but actually the spirit soul, you know, you can't cut, you can't bruise, you can't burn, you can't actually cause pain to the spirit soul, which is Satchidananda by constitution in one sense. So it's the suffering is there for the living entity is the one who's suffering. It's not the Lord who's suffering, because he's transcendental always. He's a chuta, infallible. But the suffering of the living entity is somewhat a superimposed situation. It's because he's identifying himself with the material, or himself or herself with the material body. In the same way, a dreamer identifies so many different problems in a dream, but it's actually not happening. So the living entity is suffering in material bodies, but that suffering is apparent.
So for deliberate soul.
Yes.
So what they also experience pain, but,
yes.
But that means they don't suffer, right? They
sometimes they do and sometimes they don't. There are many reasons why. You know, when a completely liberated person suffers pain, by Krishna's grace, they may sometimes not experience that pain at all. By Krishna's will, they may experience that pain and yet still maintain the consciousness that it's very difficult, but it's not actually happening to them. It's happening to the body, but they may actually, by Krishna's will, experience some pain. To some degree, they can relate to the suffering of the living entities in the material world. You know, they can actually experience. This is what they're. the liberated person is, I'm feeling this in this body, which is not mine. There's nothing actually happening to the soul. It's happening to the body, but it's great discomfort. But you know, how difficult it would be for living entities who fully identify with the body. Is also, you know, the pain of the liberated person is somewhat decreased because they don't absorb themselves in it. A conditioned soul absorbs themselves that, oh, you know, woe is me, so much difficulty, and they just, if there's some pain, they'll just focus on that pain. You know, if there's a headache, they just literally focus and they can't think of anything else. A liberated person will actually continue to focus on Krishna, Krishna's pastimes, and they're so sweet and nectarian, and that, you know, the pain can actually be there, but they can literally, to some degree, shut it out, minimize it, because their focus of attention is not on it. there are different degrees of liberation, and some liberated personalities sometimes may get little reactions to as a way of an indication that perhaps sometimes the disciples, when they see that the spiritual master is suffering because the disciples are not following properly, it can be an impetus for the disciples to then strictly follow so that they don't cause their spiritual master pain. Also, sometimes when the liberated person is actually suffering some pain or inconvenience, it's an opportunity for others to come and render a lot of service in a very intense way. And sometimes that service may not be offered, you know, if they thought that the person was just enjoying luxuriously and what have you. Sometimes when they see a liberated person in some difficulty, people may, you know, come and offer some assistance. So for many, many various reasons. It also shows that, a liberated person is prepared to suffer any amount of discomfort in their service to the Lord. You know, so one would not think that it's easy for him. He doesn't feel pain. You can stick a pin in him. You know, it's like he's like floating on a cloud. So you know, if people understand that, this saintly person actually suffered, on our behalf, then it's a testimony to their level of sacrifice, that and one should try and emulate. So for different reasons, liberated persons may or may not, according to Krishna's will, experience some, pain at different stages. But generally their suffering is nothing like the suffering of ordinary living entities. All right, so the next question was, go back there. The second question, which was given in verses 8 and 9, perhaps even 10, is that it's replied to in verses 4 to 8 of the 9th chapter. And the question was given in verses 8 and 9 of the 8th chapter. What is the specific difference between the body of the Lord and those of common living entities? This does, to some degree, also take in to consideration what is Lord Brahma's position. So let's look at verse 4. Atmatattva visudhyatam yada aha bhagavan ritam brahmane darshayan rupam avyalika vratadrittaha. O king, the personality of Godhead, being very much pleased with Lord Brahma, because of his non-deceptive penance in Bhakti Yoga, presented his eternal and transcendental form before Brahma, and that is the objective goal for purifying the conditioned soul. So, by the Lord, Prabhupada mentions in the purport somewhere there, so, first of all, we understand that the jiva is related with a body of ignorance, right? We've sort of discussed that in the first three verses. The jiva has been, although transcendental, has been placed in a body which is materially, under the material energy. Hello? Yes? Yes? You on the phone with them? Okay, yeah. I'll call them back after class. Can you see me at about Can you see me at about 6 o'clock? Will you? That's good. Thank you. Good. Thank you. That's okay. Hare Krishna. Here, the Lord actually presented his eternal and transcendental form before Brahma. In essence, that's the answer to the question that by presenting the Lord's eternal transcendental form, it cleared up any misconceptions as to whether the living entity is and the Supreme Lord are the same or whether there are differences. Prabhupada mentions in his purport, Brahma lost all misconceptions about both Paramatma and Jivatma. The wrong conception of the Jivatma is to identify the material body with the pure soul. And the wrong conception of Paramatma is to think him, Paramatma, on an equal level with the living entity. So the living entity should understand that he is of the same spiritual nature of the Supreme Lord and should not identify with the material body. By seeing the Supreme Personality of Godhead without a material body, that clears up that misconception that one can understand that that situation occurs in the spiritual world. And of course, the wrong conception about the Paramatma is to think him on an equal level with the living entity. So the Supreme Lord appearing in his transcendental form shows that even when the Lord actually appears within the material world, he does not accept a material body, you know, like the living entity. So the living entity, when he appears, the jiva, when he actually appears in the material world, he accepts a material body, becomes a material condition. But the Supreme Lord, even when he appears within the material world, he remains in his transcendental body. So he is infallible. He does not fall from his position. So there's a difference there. In verse 5 it says, Lord Brahma, the first spiritual master, the supreme in the universe, could not trace out the source of his lotus seat, and while thinking of creating the material world, he could not understand the proper direction for such creative work, nor could he find out the process for such creation. So these verses here, this verse is like a prelude to a description of the Lord's transcendental form and residence. In essence, you know, the answer is that not only is the Lord, his form, transcendental, but so is his transcendental abode, and everything about the Lord is. So this verse is, verse 5 is like a prelude to that same answer. The prelude to an expansion of the answer. Yeah. So the original question, you know, being that what is the specific difference between the body of the Lord and those of common living entities? The Lord showed his form, which was eternal and transcendental, and is the objective goal for purifying the conditioned soul. So, so that is the answer. That yes, there is a difference between the living entity and the soul, the living entities, and the Supreme Lord is that the Supreme Lord is always his form is eternal and transcendental. The living entities, you know, the living entities are identifying themselves with the material body. But the Lord never has a material body like the living entities. His body is always transcendental and full of knowledge. Part of the answer also is that the Lord purifies the conditioned souls and bestows upon them transcendental knowledge. So in other words, we can conclude from that statement that the Supreme Lord's form is spiritual by nature, because, you know, it has the potency to award liberation. So his body is eternal, transcendental. Literally, if we said, and the proof of that is that the devotees take shelter of that form and they become purified, which means they come to the spiritual platform, they become purified in material existence. You know, another way that Sridhar Swami rephrases, he restates the question that stated in the 8th chapter, that if the Supreme Lord has a material body, then how is it that the devotees become liberated simply by serving and worshipping the Supreme Lord's material body? So that's another way of restating Parikshit Maharaj's question. So that implies there must be a difference, you know. So yes, there is a difference, because his body is eternal and transcendental, and therefore they become purified by taking shelter. And as we said, verse 5 is a prelude to a further discussion on the glories of the Lord's transcendental abode and qualities and what have you. But in essence, the question is answered. So we're going to do two things now at the same time. We're going to, while continuing to look at a few verses which discuss the answer to that question, we may as well also look at the open book question, question 1, which is a personal application, where we're asked to look at the personal relevance of Lord Brahma's penance. So there's another aspect that comes up in these same descriptions. Beginning from verse 5, we see here that the personality of Godhead was very much pleased with Lord Brahma because of his non-deceptive penance and bhakti yoga. So it actually begins also another topic about penance. So we're looking at both at the same time. A sigh of relief. Select statements from verses 5 to 9 in this 9th chapter, and also from 23 to 24, which are particularly relevant to you and your current situation, challenges, etc. Write down one thing you could do based on this to improve your spiritual life. Okay, so, yeah? This piece of paper I've got in my hand. Yeah. So read that out loud, or just check you got the same as what I've got here.
Select statements from 9:5 to 9.
Yep.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. Yes. Yeah. So here, I guess in this discussion that we're doing, what I've got here is write down one thing that you could do based on this to improve your spiritual life. So you could do that during this class. If you get other things, you can do that as well. But at least one as a start to your essay. Okay, so we've got two discussions going on at the same time. We're finishing off. We've just discussed Parikshit Maharaj's answer to the question, is there a difference between the living entities and the Supreme Lord? Yes, there is. The Lord's form is transcendental and eternal. In essence, the proof of that is that his devotees meditate upon that form and become purified of material existence. Then, in verse 5, we're expanding upon that answer, and it describes that the Lord's transcendental abode is also, you know, everything about the Lord is also just as transcendental. But verse 5 also literally brings in the discussion, which is answering the first question of our essay topics that you'll need to answer. Not only the Lord's form and abode, but also his devotees are also transcendental. Again, let's trace out this picture. We've got a third thing going on in our minds, and that is we're tracing out this picture of how Brahma was literally instructed by the Lord. What actually happened? So just the narration of that story that's going on. Previously, he was submerged in the water trying to find out the source of his residence. He's seated on this lotus seat and he's thought, you know, where has this lotus seat that I'm sitting on come from? My residence? And he's gone into the water of the Garbhodaka ocean looking and could not find. He's come back to his seat he began to consider, you know, sitting there how he could begin the process of creation. of the universe. So his he's at this point, at this stage. So everyone got that picture? Is it? Yep. Any questions on that? And the purport here, Prabhupada mentions that Brahma was bewildered in the matter of creation and he could not even trace out the source of his own existence. But all this knowledge was fully achieved by him through the medium of Bhakti Yoga. By Bhakti Yoga one can know the Lord, and by knowing the Lord as the Supreme, one is able to know everything else. One who knows the Supreme knows everything else. So, Prabhupada is saying from the very beginning that Brahma's penances were Bhakti Yoga. So that, I think that's an important statement. You should write that down. Where's our scribe? All of Brahma's knowledge was achieved through the medium of Bhakti Yoga. Considering our original essay question, we're talking about things which can improve our spiritual life related to Lord Brahma's penance. So in essence, that's one clue Srila Prabhupada has given us from the very beginning, that penance, which is actually a form of bhakti yoga, reveals everything about spiritual life, Lord Brahma, actually, as Prabhupada mentioned, and he's giving a summary of what we'll find out in the next few verses, that Brahma, through bhakti, the Lord was revealed, the Lord's abode was revealed, and how to serve the Lord, all of that was revealed through his penance, which was bhakti. Now in verse 6 it describes that while thus engaging in thinking in the water, Brahmaji heard twice from nearby two syllables joined together. One of the syllables was taken from the 16th and the other from the 21st of the Sparsha alphabets, and both joined to become the wealth of the renounced order of life. Basically, yeah. So, while he was contemplating how to do the work of creating the material world, on one occasion, while he's in that contemplation, he heard from the direction of within the water the sound tapa twice. So he heard that word twice. He heard the sound, which was a word. He heard that word twice, tapa. In essence, you know, the meaning of that is perform meditation, you know, of austerity or austerity. Tapa. It means perform meditation or austerity. Penance or austerity. Prabhupada describes the beauty, penance is the beauty and wealth of the Brahmanas and the renounced order of life. And it was begun from the very beginning of creation. It was adopted by the first spiritual master, Brahma. As the means of profiting from, you know, the human form of life. Prabhupada mentions also the human being is made to undergo tapasya for going back home, back to Godhead. So, now, in essence, Brahma took this path of tapa. That is what's known as the second birth. Tapa, taking that path of tapasya. That is actually... So, in essence, Brahma become initiated by the Lord. Prabhupada mentions in his purport there that the word upashvanat is very significant. It's similar to upanayana, or bringing the disciple nearer to the spiritual master for the path of tapa. So Brahmaji was thus initiated by Lord Krishna. And this fact is corroborated by Brahmaji himself in the book Brahma Samhita. Now, what's that? By Lord Krishna. Now, at the bottom of that purport, Prabhupada also says that stated in the Brahma Samhita that Brahma was initiated into the 18-letter Krishna mantra, which is generally accepted by all the devotees of Lord Krishna. So all those coming in the Brahma Sampradaya are also initiated into that 18-letter Krishna mantra. There are verses in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, if you want to look this up, Adi Leela, chapter 5, verse 221. Lord Brahma, sitting on his lotus seat in his own abode, always meditates on him and worships him with the mantra consisting of 18 syllables. That is Klim Krishna Govindaya Gopidana Vallabhaya Swaha. I say that because it's in the book. It's in the Chaitanya Charitamrita. So it's a secret mantra, that's it, if anyone's... I don't know why I said it, but Prabhupada's written it in his book, so I'm just reading his book. Prabhupada mentions that, you know, one is able to achieve the same result or power of creation being initiated into cyclic succession. And chanting this holy mantra is the only shelter of the desireless pure devotees of the Lord. So Prabhupada is also equating the tapasya with chanting this 18-syllable mantra. That simply by doing that one gets the same perfections like Lord Brahma. It's known as the Karma Bija mantra, that one. Sometimes described as Gopala mantra as well. Aha! I was waiting for someone to answer that question. Okay. Which form do you think? What's that? You saying Gopal? Not this one. Anyone else like to hazard a guess? You're asking the question, which form did the Lord reveal to Brahma? I'm putting it back to the students who have read this chapter. Which form do you think he was saying? Is that? You're saying Narayan? You're saying Krishna? Vaikuntha, yeah. Hands up for Narayan. Hands up for Krishna. You're both correct. Because he first showed his Narayan form and later he showed the Krishna form. But at this stage of the Bhagavatam, we are talking about the Narayan form. But Prabhupada does mention in his purports how Lord Brahma, because it's important to discuss it in this section, he was also initiated into the, you know, Karma Bija Gayatri Mantra. So later Krishna also revealed his Krishna form. That's also so described in Adi Leela, chapter 5 again, but verse 22 in the purport. Prabhupada says, in the beginning of Lord Brahma's self-realization, he was shown a transcendental vision of the Vaikuntha spheres by the grace of Narayan. Later, by the grace of Krishna, he was shown a transcendental vision of Krishna Loka. So just keep that in mind, that Srila Prabhupada, you know, these events happened somewhere, you know, at the beginning of creation, the time is not so, you know, it's like it's not, you know, for instance, we might ask a disciple, you know, if we understand that someone was initiated as a brahmana, or if we know that someone is a sannyas disciple of such and such a guru, we know that that sannyas disciple must have also, received Gayatri and, Harinam initiation at some stage, you know. Sometimes it can, you know, some devotees actually receive the whole lot on one day. Some over several years, but it's not particularly important. Prabhupada is just making the point that Lord Brahma is a disciple of Krishna. There was some, in his form of Narayan, he was introduced to the vision of the spiritual world and then gradually given more and more confidential understanding up to the point of Krishna understanding, Krishna Loka. Again, some of the details of when and where that happened, we can, as we go along, they will come up. But at this stage, you know, it's probably just to understand that although Prabhupada's speaking about the 18 letter Karma Gayatri in this purport, that happened later, and it's as an incident later on after this first incident. So so there's a lot of points that we got from that about tapasya. Just one point that Prabhupada does, you know,
tapas is taking initiation by the Lord Krishna. That was Brahma's initiation. He took initiation by starting and doing tapas. Then it says you can achieve the same result by being initiated in the chain of Krishna.
Prabhupada does equate chanting of the mantras as being the tapasya or penance. Yeah, he equates, he says in the purport to verse 6 that simply by such tapasya or penance, he says, chanting of this holy mantra is the only shelter of the desireless pure devotee of the Lord. And simply by such tapasya, meaning chanting in the holy mantra, the devotee achieves all perfections like Lord Brahma. So verse 7, when he heard the sound, he tried to find the speaker, searching on all sides, but when he was unable to find anyone besides himself, he thought it wise to sit down in his lotus seat firmly and give his attention to the execution of penance as he was instructed. Hello? Yes, can I get you to call me back after 6 o'clock? Yeah, I'll be there then. Yeah, Hare Krishna. Yes. Brahma Gayatri is a different Gayatri. Yes, Brahma Gayatri is the first one. A lot of people have heard the Brahma Gayatri. I mean, in India, you can buy a clock and it's got it on the clock. You know, like a tour.
When did Lord Brahma say that?
Yes. Prabhupada's, in essence, Srila Prabhupada is skipping, you know, some of the preliminary stages of initiation and interaction between the disciple and the guru, Krishna and Brahma, and he's really just describing that. So the people understand from the very beginning that Lord Brahma is a disciple of Lord Krishna. Not just Lord Narayan, and that as a disciple of Lord Krishna, he is chanting a mantra, which is a very, very elevated, confidential understanding of the pastimes of Krishna. So he's just letting us know from the very beginning that there's more to, the Lord really, you know, fully revealed, you know, this particular Brahma. The Lord was so pleased with him that he fully revealed confidential knowledge, the topmost confidential knowledge up to Krishna understanding, understanding Krishna Leela, which is not necessarily understood by other Brahmas. So he's just letting us know from the very beginning that our Brahma, his understanding as the head of one of the four sampradayas, his understanding is particularly significant. So then we have the other sampradayas. We have the four Kumaras, we have Lakshmi, and we have Shiva, Lord Shiva. So, Prabhupada is just letting us know from the very beginning that Lord Brahma's understanding, his teachings, to his sampradaya, a second to no one. That's basically what he's letting us understand from the very beginning. So others may read Srimad Bhagavatam, but if they read and get from, properly just other things that they may never, understand, Prabhupada's from the very beginning pointing out. So anyone from any sampradaya can read Prabhupada's purports, and they'd think, this sampradaya is something special. The sampradaya coming from Brahma. And they'll learn things from Prabhupada's purports that they would not ordinarily learn from the Srimad Bhagavatam, because these understandings taken from many other Puranas, Chaitanya Charitamrita, many other Vedic statements, and Prabhupada has... So one may read the Srimad Bhagavatam but not understand a lot more information which is out there. Prabhupada's gathered it all in, so from the very beginning you understand that. That's all. Well, we'll come across the Brahma Gayatri. There is a statement, some of these things are discussed in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, that when Lord Krishna played his flute, that sound when it crossed the Viraj River, it manifested as Om. When it entered the ears of Brahma, it expanded as the Brahma Gayatri. The Brahma Gayatri expands as the four Vedas. First is the Purusha Shukta, which is an essential portion of the Vedas. The four Vedas expand then as the confidential understandings of the Vedas are there in the Pancharatrika. And the Gayatri mantra, the Vaishnava Gayatri mantra, such as the Kama Bija mantra and the Kama Gayatri, they're found in the Pancharatrika sections, which are meant for, you know, the Vaishnavas. So in other words, when the Vaishnavas, you know, we know that Vedic knowledge expands. So we have the four Vedas, you have the Puranas, you have the Mahabharata, you have the Vedanta Sutra, and finally the Vedas expand as the Srimad Bhagavatam, which is the ripened fruit of the tree of Vedic knowledge. And with the Srimad Bhagavatam are the Pancharatrika literatures in which the Vaishnav mantras expand are contained. So actually the Brahma Gayatri expands as the Kama Bija and Kama Gayatri. So after expanding into all the Vedas, it then expands into those. As the Vedas expand into the most confidential knowledge, then they expand into those Kama Bija Gayatri mantras. So the Chaitanya Charitamrita describes that Brahma Gayatri originated from the flute playing of Lord Krishna, and that sound vibration expands and sometimes forms its seed form as it leaves the spiritual world and, you know, crosses the viraj, and then begins to expand as it enters the ears of Brahma and comes out through his words like this. So, you know, it goes through different transformations. But originally it's described as coming from the flute playing of Lord Krishna. But we can, you know, there's that conversation comes up as we go a little further. We'll just touch upon it now, but we don't want to get too some of the points from verse 7, we'll need our scribe again. Now, after being initiated, of course, Brahma was fixed in his determination to do it, to execute tapasya. Now, Brahma understood that the sound was actually coming from the Lord himself. No one else was present. At this stage, he hasn't seen anyone. He's just heard tappa, tappa. That. But he has understood that this has come from the Lord. The Lord has initiated me on the path of penance, and that path of penance will reveal everything. He's understood that sound vibration and that penance, activity of penance, are non-different from the Lord. How did he understand that? How did Lord Brahma understand? What's that? Yes. So then, how would he know that sound was generated by the Lord, and by that tapa, the Lord wanted him to perform? That's my question. If he's the only living entity, how would he know? He was enlightened from within. And how do we know that? It's stated where? In the purport. And which verse does it also state it? Very first verse of the Srimad Bhagavatam states that Brahma was enlightened from within by the Supreme Lord. But that's already been stated. So that, you know, so just putting the pieces together, he has heard the sound, but being enlightened from within, he's understood. This is, you know, sound vibration, non-different from the Lord. The Lord wants me to perform this penance, the tapasya, meditation, austerity. By that, everything will be revealed by the Lord, how I can, how he can understand the Lord and how to serve the Lord in the process of creation. So, Prabhupada makes a point here that he initiated Brahma because he was willing to receive the initiation, and the Lord can similarly initiate everyone who is inclined to have it. So, of course, following in the footsteps of Brahma, we understand that after being initiated, we should perform penance or tapasya. Specifically, devotional service, that becomes more clear as we go through. now, on the point of being enlightened from within, Prabhupada does make the point that one should not think oneself on the level of Brahma to be initiated directly from the Lord within. In the present age, no one can be accepted as pure as Brahma. The Prabhupada does make mention in the purport that that one can have the same facility through the unalloyed devotees, through scriptural injunctions and the spiritual master. So one can't imitate Brahma, but all the same facilities are there. Brahma didn't have association with unalloyed devotees. He didn't have a visible spiritual master at that stage. He didn't have any books of knowledge. But all that we have. Okay. So Lord Brahma underwent penances for 1,000 years by the calculation of the demigods. He heard this transcendental vibration from the sky and he accepted it as divine. Thus, he controlled his mind and senses, and the penances he executed were a great lesson for the living entities. Thus he is known as the greatest of all ascetics. Now, just a little timeline. Perhaps you could write this down in another colour, perhaps up the top. You got all the pens. Have you got all the colours?
Yes.
Yeah. Just up the top. One celestial year is equal to 6 times 30 times 12 times 1,000 of our years.
Is it?
That appears to be
one.
So we could say 2,160,000 of our years is one celestial year. Is that right? As our mathematicians. So that means that he underwent penances for another three zeros to that, and that's how long he went for. Yeah. So that number times 1,000. Yeah. Yeah. By our years, that's how long he meditated. This is all taking place in the first day of Brahma. You know, that's because you know, one Divya Yuga or one cycle of the four Yugas is about 2 million years. Is that right? Roughly. One cycle of the four Yugas is that about two? Yeah, it's about 2 million years or something. More. More than that, yeah.
4 minutes.
Yeah, maybe about 4 minutes. So it's